When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Today on Lightning Bugs.
It was the three tenors and, and Sarah Brightman and Andrea Bocelli and Charlotte Church and all these kind of singers. And it was like people were just going, oh, my God. It was like introducing people to the sound of classical music without having to go headfirst into the full realm of classical music. And so it was kind of this classical crossover world. And here I was just kind of this baritone 17-year-old kid who liked all kinds of stuff. I was listening to, you know, rock and Sondheim and, you know, a hell of a lot of Ben Folds and, you know, it was just all kinds of things. So I knew that this was going to be a lonely path for me because I knew I didn't really fit into any of the categories that I just mentioned. I knew that I was never going to be able to just do that. And so David Foster, who I give a huge amount of credit to for discovering me and mentoring me and just overall being a genius to be around, a masterclass to be around 24/7. And also mostly for him saying to me, don't look at where everybody is zigging, you know? Look, he says 99%, this will break even, you'll go on with your life. But if people resonate with what you're doing, the good news is nobody's looking for it. The good news is nobody cares. Radio's not going to play you. Nobody's waiting for the next hit. Nobody's paying attention. So the good news is if you do hit people with this, it's going to be because they really got goosebumps and really wanted to pay attention.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot. Hello and welcome to Lightning Bugs, conversations with me, Ben Folds, about creativity. It's Thursday. New podcast. Today's guest is singer, songwriter, and actor, Josh Groban. The man sold millions of records. He's performed all around the world. He's done everything. In 2017, he starred in the hit Broadway musical Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. The Great Comet was a great musical, and he slayed that. He's been in TV shows, films, The Good Cop, Crazy Stupid Love, The Office, and maybe most impressively, and not surprisingly, knowing the man, he's really full-timed a foundation called Find Your Light, and it is to support schools and the arts. It's very effective. They raise a lot of money and do a lot of good things, and Josh and his family stay personally involved in that. Such a young age for him to give back so much. What an impressive dude. Let me bring in my friend, Josh Groban. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm so good. I'm so happy to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
If you're listening to the podcast, you can't see my beaming right now to see friend Ben. But yeah. It's good to see you. You are all the way across the globe from me. Is that right?
I am. Yeah, I'm in Sydney. Wow. You in LA?
I'm in LA. I mean, two cities that have infuriatingly great weather all the time.
Well, I was just going to do something I haven't done with the other guests, which is go straight to your childhood. Because I want to figure out how you got to be you, because your parents, they seem like your best buds. Like that's not the case for everybody. I mean, maybe you put on a good show, but I mean, like, you guys seem like they were really supportive of your art. But are they artistic themselves?
They are artistic themselves, and I do recognize that I'm just so unbelievably lucky to have parents that were great parents, because you can be too much of like a best friend as a parent too.
Yeah.
Because you know, you can be like the, oh, I just want to be your pal, and then there's
right.
no discipline and there's no boundaries, and you know, that can be a bad thing too. So like, you know, Jack and Lindy had the really good balance of being just kind of good parents
Do you call them by their first names like that?
No, I just only in the context of the interview.
Okay, I understand. That's good.
Their names are Jack and Lindy.
No, you're
that would have fallen into the category of too close. Or if you're trying to be passive aggressive to your step parent or something, be like, "Hey, mom. Hey, Kevin."
That's right. Or their full name.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But they, you know, my mom kind of decided to become full time at the mom job when my brother and I were born, and now we have an amazing time doing philanthropic work together, and she's brilliant. And my dad is kind of an executive recruiter now. He is. He's been a what they call a headhunter for many years. He helps find people jobs. But before both of those incarnations, for both of them, my dad was a jazz trumpet player in college, and my mom a junior high school art teacher. So the two of them are both actually really artistic, and then kind of, you know, decided not to do it professionally because they wanted to keep loving it. And they didn't, you know, feel like it was ultimately something that they would be able to or want to do kind of with all the pressures and things like that. So, but they get it. They totally get it. So when my brother and I would have an interest in the piano or seeing a play or, you know, getting a book of monologues or whatever it was, they were supportive of that. They didn't push it. Growing up in LA, it would have been so easy to kind of say, oh, my kid has a knack. Let's put the spinny bow tie on him and send him out. They just supported it, left me in my room, put a piano in the living room. I was very lucky. It's why you and I both are pounding the pavement for the arts, is because having them be kind of a guiding light to find my way in those areas just is a huge reason why I do it. I'm very lucky.
Yeah. So, you know, living in LA, your parents artistic, but not stage parents at all.
Very of earth. A lot of neighbors that were stage families. And I think also because they both believed so strongly in education and in having backup plans, you know, they, I think, were both excited by the fact that I had the bug, but also, you know, more than a little bit nervous that maybe...
Well, you were really young.
I was young. Oh, yeah. I mean, I was just absolutely mesmerized and hooked on the theater when I was 4 years old.
So it was theater first for you?
It was first. Oh yeah, it was. And it was first like watching it on television, strangely enough. It was watching, you know, PBS broadcasts of Sunday in the Park with George and, you know, listening to the cast recording of Phantom of the Opera before I ever even got to see Phantom of the Opera, you know, just kind of...
As a kid. That's amazing. I love that.
Yeah, and just kind of saying, this is magic, like the kind of magic that a lot of other kids were saying, I want to be a fireman or a cowboy or whatever.
Yeah.
I was like,
well, this also, was other kids' idea of entertainment is going to be, I mean, nothing wrong with it, but it's going to be more like cartoons and Pokemon and superheroes and, you know.
I did like those things too.
But you didn't become a superhero. You became a singer and a theater person.
Very much so. You know, but that distinction is interesting because I had the same kind of whims and hobbies that all the other kids had. But there was something about the feeling of theater, the feeling of that kind of art form that just resonated deeper than a hobby.
Live theater? Like, did you get a sense that it was live? Was that part of what the thrill was when you were a kid? Or did it seem in the air as a production, like filmed and its own thing?
You know, it's like anything that gives you an aha moment that is an art form. It's seeing a great painting for the first time, or, you know, if you're of legal drinking age, drinking a great glass of wine for the first time and going, oh, wow, that's what that can do. That's what it did to me at that young age. And I, of course, when you're a kid, you not only say to yourself, I'm a huge fan of this, you want to be it. It's like why everybody on TikTok is dancing the dance moves of their favorite pop stars. It moves you deeply because, and you want to then be that. So that's what Sondheim and, you know, others did for me back then, was that I felt it deeply and I wanted to be it because I felt it. And it really was about the storytelling. I just resonated with the story. I would not have been interested in the story of George Seurat and you know, postmodernist, you know, or post-Renaissance painting or whatever it was, a pointillist painting. I would not have been interested in that subject, but I became interested because of the musical. And that's what it showed me, is that it had the power to tell stories.
So your earliest favorite musicals?
my earliest favorite musicals were Cats. I mean, I tell you, as a child, seeing the Cats run around the audience and singing that incredible poetry.
Did you see it live or did you see it?
So Cats was my first musical. Cats, okay. Well, I was around 9. They took me to see Cats at the Amundsen, I think it was the Amundsen Theater here in Los Angeles. And I mean, it's, you know, people have kind of, given cats a bad rap over the years, just because I think, like, in hindsight, it's, you know, well, it's about cats. And so it's kind of, you know, people are just like, oh my God. But as a child, especially, and Weber is a genius, full stop.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to hear those chords and to hear the poetry and the playfulness of it, around the time it had just come out, I was just like, so I actually showed this picture when I co-hosted the Tonys a couple of years ago, with our friend Sarah Bareilles. A picture of me, and I wanted to be a cat from Cats. So my mom, and I talk about, you know, being supportive parents, they made me a kind of sequined cats sweatshirt, spandex, and like silver high tops. And I loved it. I really loved it.
Your parents made it.
They made it for me. Yeah, which just shows how deep their support, you know, for just any artistic whim that I had. They were just like, go for it. Yeah. And I think it was amazing. Should all kids be so lucky to have parents that are just like, you know what? Yeah, you're feeling that? Go do it.
Well, I mean, the thing is like this, the reason one of the many reasons I wanted to do the podcast is just to get inside, if you're a parent, when you have kids, that's what you do when you're a parent. I guess no one really knows how to best foster creativity. And it's just good to see how it's done. I mean, some artists grow up and it's like, my old man used to beat me, and, you know, it's rough. Like, they had a rough time and I had to escape, you know. And so it's all about the opposite. And then with some of us, I mean, I think both of our sets of parents were supportive of it, which, like you say, it makes you really feel like you got to give back a little bit and make sure that as many other people can be as lucky as you were, which is I see in your efforts, you know.
Well, I mean, I am 40 and childless, and I would love to have kids one day. And I think part of the pressure for me has been like, there is something to be said for being in a situation where you say to yourself, I'm going to break the cycle. I'm going to be the parent that that my parents weren't, and I'm going to be the one to have a great, healthy relationship. The way, you know, like the kid had to put out cigarettes on us, and it's a, you know, there's real. I'd say most families out there, you know, have, you know, nobody's perfect. No family's perfect. Every family has their own stuff and their own dynamics and their own dysfunctional things, including my own. And we've all grown, and I'm so lucky. But I think there's both of those pressures. One is I'm going to break the cycle. I'm not in that category, but I am in the category of I want to live up to how great my parents were. And so there's that pressure of just like, oh man, my dad was home all the time. He came home from work 6 o'clock every day, had a scotch, and hung out with the kids. And, you know, I tour, and it's just like, there's just a lot that I think about, like, I want to be the dad that my dad has been to me. And it's, I think in some ways that pressure maybe is kind of like made me hold back a little bit.
So interesting.
I got to get over that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as soon as it happens, having had kids myself, all that goes by the wayside. And it's just like, you jump on a roller coaster at the point that they take that terrible picture, and you go, you know, like
that's, but
that's
what every
life.
Great parent that's in our line of work, like yourself, has said to me, which is that, you know, you can think about it and you can think about it and you can think about it. And at the end of the day, you show up at the hospital as two people and you drive home as three, and you just go for it. And it just happens, and that nothing's perfect, and you just do it. So
I always found advice obnoxious as hell from other parents, because you get it all the time. And I found myself, once I had them, you know, going and doing the same thing, I try to shut up, because every kid is completely different. But I think what is useful is to just see as many honest examples of the production line of children and go, okay, well, that one was made with too much salt, and that one was cooked for a little too long, you know, like, just kind of look at it and see, because you can have, like, my having twins, they were totally different.
Sure.
They were totally different. Like if I had established any rules based on just one of them, if it just had one, I would have had a certain mindset. But seeing them be twins and almost be opposite in so many ways, despite the fact they were treated pretty much exactly the same.
It's the nature versus nurture. There was a great CNN documentary about these triplets. Did you see it? I forgot. I'd love to name drop it on your podcast, but I forgot. But look it up. Google CNN triplets documentary. It was this horrible thing that this orphanage did where they separated triplets at birth to three different families. And it was like a secret government
experiment. I did see that.
If it was a nature versus nurture experiment to see if different upbringings from different types of families would change the way they were. And then, of course, they met later on. And at first they thought, oh, my God, it was nature because they all loved the same cigarettes and they all had the same taste in music and books and food and women and all this other thing. And then all of a sudden, slowly but surely, the difference in upbringing came out in them. And, you know, it's a hodgepodge, but it's a fascinating thing. Three identical strangers.
That's what it was. At the same time, though, I do not envy anyone who finds success in the entertainment business, specifically the music business, younger than 30 years old. Like when I think about your trip, that's crazy to me. And I think you would have needed to be armed. I don't know why you're not out of your fucking mind as it is. Like I went through if you went through like a triple cheese grinder at how old, like 17, 18 years old?
Yeah, 17. I was discovered. Yeah.
I went through like a quarter cheese grinder at 30. And I found it very, very unbalancing. And while I want to be really, really thankful for our awesome careers, the fact that we get to do what we want and create things, I also think it's kind of bullshit to tell people, you know, kids, parents, even an audience, that it's a walk in the park. Because we don't like to complain because it doesn't look, you know, it's like, you know, Hollywood elites complaining about their lives. But just putting all that in perspective and understanding that, yes, you're lucky. How tough do you see that as having been now in retrospect? Are you still skidding from that?
You know, I think there can be a balance of deep gratitude for the opportunity and also an understanding of just, you know, psychologically, we're not meant for this. You know, our brains aren't programmed to be under the microscope this way, to deal with just unending praise on one ear and unending criticism on the other. It messes with our egos. And I say ego in like the natural sense of the word, not like a Trump kind of ego, just our you know, our sense of self. And so it does. I am lucky for a couple of things. One is that I was a young 17-year-old. I mean, I was really, you know, my voice didn't change until like 13 and a half. And I was just kind of a sheltered kind of kid. Like I was very blissfully naive at 17.
I like that you know that it was 13 and a half. That means you were singing a lot and you were noticing it.
I was singing. I was, when I was in seventh grade and part of the choir, I was up like this and doodly doo. And, you know, I had a beautiful boy soprano voice, but I remember as I became a teenager, like you never forget when your voice drops, you wake up and you kind of go, oh, okay. You know, and all of a sudden there's that year of weirdness where all of a sudden your beautiful singing range becomes not quite where you want it to be.
Mm.
And then you eventually grow into it and I started to become like, oh, I'm a baritone now. Okay, so I'm going to start learning songs in this range and all that. But then, you know, when I think about, okay, there's 13 and a half, maybe close to 14, still kind of not changed yet. And then like figuring out period and then 16 really discovered and then 17, close to 18 kind of signed. It was crazy. So I was lucky that I didn't have social media back then because I think that was a game changer for feelings of self-loathing and insecurity and bullying and all of the things that make us feel terrible when we doom scroll. To have had that back then, be a different guy, different story. I think I would not have been strong enough to handle it.
That's good information. I mean, it is. That's a good thing
to
think about.
And it scares me as a hopeful future parent. It scares me a lot because it's real. Like it's changing psychology in very, very profound ways.
Without naming names, can you think of now people who are the next generation from you that you see, you look fondly, almost parentally coming up and you see them dealing with that and they're like, do you feel like you have like anecdotal?
I just recently did an episode of American Idol where I did some mentoring, did a couple of duets with a couple of the contestants and did some mentoring. And These two contestants are unbelievably talented and great artists, and they've got bright futures. And one of the things they talked to me about was that, you know, they had now been on the show for about 3 weeks, and this was their first time doing a song in front of what will be a live audience because of COVID and all that. But they had kind of come out of nowhere, both very young, and both had just kind of been on TV, been on national television for 3 weeks straight. And one of the top things that they were talking about was, boy, I'm really getting it online. Like, I'm getting the vocal criticisms. I'm getting, you're the most incredible thing. You're going to be a superstar. I'm getting trolled and bullied, you know? And so I think that, you know, I say I wouldn't have been able to deal with it back then, but I also think that there's a social media literacy that young people are growing up with, that muscle that I didn't have.
That's right. I think that too. And that's one of the reasons I'm asking this. Yeah.
And I think that they actually, as every generation does, you know, over the course of the history, they're growing up with muscles that I think hopefully will keep them a little more down the center to all the, you know, white hot nonsense that's coming out from all sides of social media, because it's just endless.
It is endless. Yeah. You know, I think the same thing. I think that, and that's why I kind of ask you if you would think of somebody, because what I notice is that, those of us who grew up without social media and then were hit with it later didn't have the antibodies for it. And I watch my kids and people that age, and as I watched them grow up with it, saw some really interesting things happen where they're much more in control of their what their egos are hit with. Now, they're not artists or they're not, you know, they're not going to be professional, I don't think. They're 21 years old, but they know how to put it in perspective.
It's perspective, exactly.
I honestly will not have that. So I choose not to look at it because I know that I was not inoculated for this. I grew up in an era where I think people said to your face what they meant. And when I see that, I'm like, oh man, you know, this guy with no name and no face, this is real, you know?
This egg is really nasty.
That's right, a nasty egg.
Yeah.
A bad apple.
I know, it's hard if you haven't been, you know, it's funny you say inoculated, like it's, you know, it's things go viral. Like it is like a kind of like a disease.
Like
can you handle the disease or can't you? And, you know, I was just on the cusp of coming into the music business, right? As like the internet was being sent to us in the mail, you know, and that's my generation of just kind of growing into, well, you've got mail. But it's true. Because I didn't grow up with that, I'll read things or I'll look at things, or I actually don't now. I've kind of gotten off of a lot of social media because I just found it was just, you know, it was bad for my mental health. And also kind of, I was realizing a waste of my time and energy. Because you take it so seriously. And I think that generation has learned to not take everything so seriously, which maybe in its own right is healthier, as long as they're taking the right things seriously.
Well, therein lies sort of the big contradiction as an artist, a creative person, is that if it's your job, when you're approved of, you get cookies. Like you get paid. You have a job, people clap, and you get to do things. You get to buy things. If people don't approve, then you don't. And yet, what's supposed to make us artists or better artists is to not care about that stuff.
Yeah.
And both things exist. And any artist that tells me that they don't care, I'm like, I don't know. This person is either a psychopath or they're not being truthful about it, but there is a way to build a firewall. At 17, 18 years old, you're singing a style that I cannot say was in fashion.
Correct.
In fact, you're still doing it, and it's still not in fashion. And that is awesome. I think that is just the best.
Well,
talk about that. Why? How did that happen? Why didn't you go with the flow and move that voice into a style that would? How did you? I think that's one of your great artistic achievements, is being so against the grain and so yourself that it's not you can't imitate it, and no one else is or should try it. That's what a fucking achievement that is.
Because well, we it takes one to know one, Ben. I mean,
well, we do invent a voice to a degree. You could like sing like someone else.
Oh, sure. That's okay, what karaoke's for.
Yeah. So what you got to say about that Josh Groban?
Couple of things I got to say about that shit. One is to the point where, yes, it was decidedly not en vogue to sing the style of music that I was singing at the time. At the same time, when I first kind of started to blow up, it was a time when that style of music was actually getting a lot of sales. So I had kind of a window where somebody with my style, I guess, could we could roll the dice.
That was a Europe thing more. Maybe that was a European thing more, you think?
It took me way longer to break in Europe than it did in America. Huh. So, it was one of those things. It was the three tenors and Sarah Brightman and Andrea Bocelli and Charlotte Church and all these kind of singers. And it was like, people were just going, oh my God. It was like introducing people to the sound of classical music without having to go head first into the full realm of classical music. And so it was kind of this classical crossover world. And here I was just kind of this baritone 17-year-old kid who liked all kinds of stuff. I was listening to, rock and Sondheim and, a hell of a lot of Ben Folds and, it was just all kinds of things. So I knew that this was going to be a lonely path for me because I knew I didn't really fit into any of the categories that I just mentioned. I knew that I was never going to be able to just do that. And so David Foster, who I give a huge amount of credit to for discovering me and mentoring me and just overall being a genius to be around, a masterclass to be around 24/7. And also mostly for him saying to me, don't look at where everybody is zigging. Look, he says 99%, this will break even. You'll go on with your life. But if people resonate with what you're doing, the good news is nobody's looking for it. The good news is nobody cares. Radio's not going to play you.
Right.
That's nobody's waiting for the next hit. Nobody's paying attention. So the good news is if you do hit people with this, it's going to be because they really got goosebumps and really wanted to pay attention. And so we kind of wrote our own playbook. And that was lonely for a long time. It sucks when you're the top selling male artist of the year and Grammys don't care. Like you said, people pretend they don't care, but you're like, why aren't I in the club? It's a lonely existence to kind of go your own way. But what you realize later on is that you've actually kind of paved your own path for yourself with your fan base and with what you do so that you can actually now go in any direction you want to go into. And so that's a luxury that I know you know as well, because you've constantly done things your way and you've constantly explored and experimented and dared your audience to go to places that might feel uncomfy at first, but then they realize they didn't know what they could do without it. So that's the goal.
So how old were you? I'm sorry to ask you basic bio questions, but how old were you when you met David Foster?
16.
So you guys were having pretty long-term strategical discussions, or he was kind of in some way, he was hugely successful. So I suppose
because David has discovered so many of the great singers in the world. And so he's always, I think, on a talent search. It's just part of his DNA. But I didn't know that. To me, I was plucked out of high school. We met through a voice teacher and he just wanted me to sing for an event. And I was just thinking, how lucky am I that I get to, be a part of this crazy world for 5 minutes. In my head, I was not thinking to myself, because I listened to the radio and knew what was out there and what wasn't, not thinking he's going to be actually interested in working with me. So it was actually a long time. It was like a year after that of constantly singing for him, constantly being surprised to get the call to sing for him for something. And then eventually he would have me sing in the backyard of somebody who was an executive at the label. And then eventually that person would invite another executive. And then they'd kind of go, David, this kid, keeps getting standing ovations. What's going on here? This is not sellable by any stretch of any book we have, but people are responding. What do you want to do here? And David said, Let me take a chance. Let me gamble on this, and the rest I fell up.
How much did you think about prior to David? Did you experience? There's I think most people struggle to find their voice, and voice is obviously, both that and that. How much did you experiment with sounding like? Ray Charles for 5 minutes and then Bob Dylan for a little while longer and then Neil Young.
You spend a year in a studio with the producer and you've got all kinds of demos that you hope don't make the light of day where you're just kind of like,
life is a masquerade.
Parade. Yeah, well, one day. Is it released? It might be. I think it's out there, right?
It's out there. It's
on YouTube somewhere.
Yeah.
People still don't think that was a joke, which I kind of like more.
Yeah.
It maybe has become not a joke. I think we wrote it. See, this is an interesting writing exercise, is to like kind of like take off your serious, I want to write a good, serious, clever song
mm-hmm.
thing and kind of write for like humor purposes.
Well, let me fill the kiddies in on that just for a second, because that's
yeah, sure.
you and me in the middle of a night. Was it after one of my gigs?
It was, I think after one of your, no, it was after your video shoot with Tim and Eric.
Right.
We had done your You Don't Know Me video shoot and Tim Heidecker said, hey, I've got a lyric idea or something. We all hung out and he's like, I've got a lyric idea.
Well, I had been making fake songs, like bad songs on purpose and releasing them as though they were real. And that was just my way of just making something with no pressure, I think. And I thought it was kind of funny.
Yeah. It was,
and
very
I thought,
kind
well,
of Andy Kaufman-esque. You were enjoying kind of trolling a little bit.
Yeah, and it also there's another story behind it which has to do with the leaking of the album prior to that, and that being a way. I just told the label we should just all the same titles, but everything else is different, and it sounds believable, but it sucks.
Okay,
and that way, if it's leaked to the internet, people will. I mean, and like you know, reviewers reviewed the album as if. It was the fake album. And then when the real one came out, they were like, oh, that's not as good.
Yeah, that's brilliant. See, that's oh, well, what do they know? Fuck
Christ. So we had gone in and I think we all had, it's me and you and Tim Heidecker of Tim and Eric. And Tim's taking it pretty seriously. I mean, like he actually is Andy Kaufman.
But I can't tell though if he was taking it seriously
because
the guy is so dry.
Yeah,
and you don't know when he's kind of on and off in that dryness. And so he Life is a Masquerade. I think was that his lyric or was that yours?
That's his lyric, and then I just made music out of it for
then
the most part.
And
then we just threw it together real fast. I don't remember who did what exactly, but that was his lyric. And yeah, he's not. It's not that he doesn't realize that things are a joke. It's just that he thinks that, I mean, to him, that's a serious part of life and a serious way of dealing with it. I mean, have you heard his record?
And he has made some beautiful music.
It's very good. Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Fear of Death is awesome.
Yeah. Wonderful music. Yeah. No, he's incredible. He's a good songwriter.
I agree.
And real,
I like his voice
artist.
Too. But the point is so we made this super fast to you and me. It was more of a joke. We even had to talk about it in the car on the way back. Maybe we shouldn't let anyone hear this.
I remember that.
You know, it's kind of like, maybe we should let anyone hear.
I was just pulling up to my house and I'm just like, you know, Ben, I feel weird. I've got that funny, bad feeling, you know? It's just... because at that point, but also like, you know, I've done a lot of comedy since then, but like at that point also, like you knew that I had a weird sense of humor.
Yeah.
And we shared in that, but I don't think a lot of other people did either. And so... So I kind of drove him going, oh man, this is going to be, this is not, I'm not sure people are going to get it the way we get it. We were very, very dry, our humor, very
dark. It sounded pretty serious.
Yeah.
And to a degree, it's like the exercise of making something does, we are going to take it seriously to a degree. I mean, it's like the tape's rolling. This is,
we had a proper jam sesh.
You played this mean ass Nord synthesizer.
I ripped
lead.
The Nord. Absolutely. That was just a one taker. Couldn't repeat it if I tried. No, magic existed that night. Magic existed. Where were we? The record plant? I mean, that's the other thing. We were in like a $20,000 room or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean,
somehow it got leaked. And I don't know how that happened. I don't know if the studio guy did that or Tim did that. I didn't do it, but he got up there.
Well, it's out there, and I think it's an art piece in itself because people either are taking deep, serious meaning from it, and they really love it, and they request it at my shows, or they think it's hysterical. And what a cool kind of, you know, Rorschach test that song is.
Give the listenership, should there be any of that, an exercise. A creative exercise. I'm calling it New Week's Resolution, as in, for this week, I resolve to wake up every morning and read poetry, or I'm going to say magic words before I go to bed, or I'm going something specific that doesn't take too much time. It's realistic that you think would help a creative audience mix it up in their head, something that makes them Josh Groban.
Well, I think we all are looking for silver linings in this otherwise traumatic and awful year. And especially people who are creative, I think, have been trying to find ways in which they can say at the end of all this, well, I've grown in this way, or I've gotten better at this at least. And I'm going to just do all I can to incinerate the rest, but then I'm going to hold on to these things that were positive. And for me, you know, always kind of needing noise, always kind of needing distraction, always kind of bouncing from one thing to another, I realized in this year of quiet that it was actually doing me a disservice to have all that distraction, to constantly have, you know, a million things I could do instead of finish that verse, or a million people I could just call up and go write with or go do or make noise with. You know, I think having, and also just getting to know your own thoughts, you forget how vital it is to just sit and think. I know you and I both like to meditate. I have been, and I think more loosely than you have, I kind of come and go, but I think this challenge, I think, is one for myself as well. You don't have to be into meditation, but I would say that when first thing you do when you wake up in the morning, before you decide to start the noise, is just to sit with your eyes closed and just be quiet for a little bit and just reflect. I just want to jump out of bed, have a coffee, and just start stuff. And I've always found that when I just start my day with quiet, if you want to download a meditation app and do a guided meditation, if you want to look into TM or do all those other things, I think they're great. But I really think that the main thing is just kind of before you make any big decisions or make any big creative choices that day, start your day listening to your inner voice for a minute. And that's a hard thing for me to do too. So I'm going to try.
I love that. Okay. So to be specific, you're going to get up, not do this in bed because that's just laying in bed. You're going to get up and you're going
to
go.
Bed. What? I would say if you have an opportunity to do it near some fresh air, a very kind breeze, if you can do it like sit outside.
Yeah. A polite breeze.
Get up, get out to a polite breeze, whether it's by a window or outside, if you have a deck or a yard. And just start your day with a little let's add a little nature to it. I think that's good.
How long? Because people are real literal. I am about my exercises. So Josh told me to.
I'm going to say 5 minutes.
Awesome, man.
I'm going to say five. I think that's a manageable amount of time. When we're antsy to start our day, I think that 5 minutes can feel like 30. Feel free to extend should you feel, but I'm going to say start with five.
I have to shut this door back here. There's water on both sides and the wind goes shifting and I have to change doors and windows because they start banging around.
We're at a wind shift. Hold tight, everybody. Wind shift, closing doors. Well, Ben's left the podcast entirely. He's gone out the door and closed it. So I'm going to just finish things up here by saying, what a treat Ben is. What an all-around awesome guy. Great. I mean, extraordinarily brilliant talent, as you all know. Funny as all get up. Great interviewer. Hey, the post-its are... wait, he's back.
Thanks. He's still there. I'm glad. Thank you.
I wasn't talking about you.
You know, I don't know if you were briefed on this or not, but I make a song with every guest. It's the first time we met. We got together in Nashville, and we were going to write a song. And
that's right.
We didn't do it because we just ended up having fun instead. And I think I don't regret that. I think that's cool. We had a good
fun's
day.
Great. While you were gone, I was singing about the wind
were
coming
you?
Through your house. I was singing about the wind shift. Yeah.
Oh, can I hear that again? Can you recreate the magic?
Wind shift blowing through Ben's room. Wind shift. I hope it doesn't make the mic go boom. Wind is an extrovert. Do we not want that?
No, that's cool. I don't care.
Wind is the extrovert that we were, you know, saying we didn't want to be. The wind is coming in and saying, hey, I'm here too, guys. Just know you can talk about all you want, but nature finds a way.
Yeah, wow. See,
so there's a lot of things in this song because first I'm like delighted by the breeze. And then I'm thinking about how rude the breeze was to even interrupt us at all.
Rude
and then
breeze.
I had some abandonment issues because you rude breeze. It's pretty good. And then I had some management issues because you left to close the door, and then I heard the door close, and then you were gone. So I just thought
you left me here. What are your two notes for Rude Breeze? Just right out of it.
My two notes for Rude Breeze? Rude Breeze. I guess that's more than two notes.
No, that's okay.
Rude breeze interrupting our song. You're a rude breeze. Why can't we just get along?
Oh, that's good. We got this.
Yeah.
Rude breeze.
Yeah. Is that all you need, or do you need more? More?
Rude breeze.
Oh, that's good.
What you gonna do? I feel you blowing with that attitude.
when did you write your first song?
Just now. Thank you for shepherding me. Thank you for shepherding me.
This is important.
I don't know. I think that I was always writing and I didn't know it. I think, you know, when I mentioned that my parents had a piano in the living room, I would just sit at the piano and just riff just to kind of get over the awfulness of the school day and just kind of get my head right before homework. And I would just play. I would just play for an hour. And I didn't realize that that was writing. I thought it was just, you know, having fun. And then I started to realize that those little improvisations or those little things I was doing that were just kind of silly and of the moment that were never supposed to be repeated were actually, you repeat that and that's called a verse. Or that's, you know, then you, if that's, you can't get that melody out of your head after you played it yesterday, well, maybe that's something that should be a chorus. And you start to think a little bit about structure. And then I really started writing after my first album because the blessing, the curse of having a hit album and even a hit song is that every publisher under the sun then says, oh, we got to get him 50 more of that. And so it's like a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. It gets watered down to like a cartoonish, you're listening to songs and you're going, is this what they think of me? Like, is this what they think I feels good to me? It became so dumbed down of what it was that I thought I was trying to do in the first place that really starting to write came from the impetus of like, okay, well, get off your ass and write. You know what you don't want. Go write what you do want, or at least try. Go co-write a little bit. Just at least put a little bit of your voice in this, you know. And so, you know, I've tried to learn as much as I can from every incredible writer that I've been lucky enough to co-write with. And as you know, it's a long process to getting semi-good. You know, it's, you know, I'm sure it happened for you very, very quickly. But for me, you know, David Foster would say, you know, you write 100, so you get 2 or 3 great. You know, and I didn't think of it that way. I thought of it as just like, oh, I thought of things, something in the shower. That's something I have to show the world. And I've learned to be a little bit, have more discretion with when I really feel something is special. You learn to kill your babies with writing, which I've learned. So
yeah, which is probably another reason you haven't become a parent.
That's dark, Ben.
Yeah, only isn't it music. Funny how this is not an era. This is an era where we get really nervous really quickly about anything dark. We don't deal. I mean, in the 90s, everything went dark just because everything was so great. Everything was so fucking easy in the 90s that we had to make like chainsaw movies and jokes about everything. And now it's kind of like, you know, we've got enough of that in the news. Why don't we
a lot of pain out there.
Yeah.
But even so, I think there's a place for dark and dark humor.
I think so too. But it is interesting how we've all grown a reflex. I can feel it myself. Right before I said that, I was like, nah, kill babies, you know, like.
And it happened.
Yeah.
It's, look, this is where I defer to my comedy friends. You know, I said things that, you know, I regret that I would, you know, were like kind of off color, or dirty or whatever in the moment to get a laugh. And I think like, oh, that didn't sit well. You know,
you know, all the comedy people seem to say is if you say it on stage, it's got sort of there's a barrier. There's a professional
performance.
Barrier.
There's a performance around it. Yeah.
And if you say it on my podcast, you're fucked.
I keep all my dirty language and dirty jokes to podcasts and private, you know,
did your parents cuss?
No, God, no.
Yeah.
Like my mom would have to make a swear word Polish in order to say it. She'd be like, oh, shitsky, you know? And, so, you know, that was the only way to get around saying a swear was like making it cute.
You know what?
Now, but now, Now I hear swear words more, and I realize I just had to wait till I was 40 to feel comfortable saying just, oh, fuck it.
Yeah.
That, mostly if I say a review, if I say, oh, this person said this thing, or whatever. Oh, just, oh, fuck it. It's like, yes, you're right.
My father cussed like a sailor. I mean, it's like every other word. That's just what it was around the house. And I look at it as kind of like, I
probably watered it down to you. Probably didn't think of it as a big deal.
I think so. It was just part of language. But I find that it really, it's a real class thing. It's like, I look up to people who get through life without using unnecessary words. They come out of me reflexively, and I think, boy, you just showed your idiocy there. Like, I feel like an idiot when it comes out, and it still comes out. It's almost like it is slightly Tourette's in that way. And then I go, I'm going to do this event, and I'm not going to say anything nasty. And then that's when it comes out.
Well, it's a challenge. I think that language can be beautiful. Even naughty language can be incredibly useful. And I'm certainly not a prude about that.
You don't have any fucks or anything on your records.
I don't. Yeah. No, I have a damn. I don't have any shits.
You give no fucks on your records.
I give absolutely no fucks on my records. It's true. You're going to use that one line as my promo for this podcast, aren't you?
You did the song I wanted, one of the only songs I ever wanted to cover on a record, and I thought I would cover it on a record one day, and
really?
You just did it.
That's what covers are for. I'm probably the 500th person to do it.
Now I don't feel like I can do it.
No.
But you Everybody did it needs a so bend. Well. It sounds well. So great. Solitaire.
What is it?
By Neil Sedaka.
I do love that song.
Love that song.
It gets me. That song gets me.
Did you know I ripped that song off? And when I say rip that song off, let me preface that with it was an inspiration for a song for which I could not be sued because it's not close enough.
The Sedaka lawyers stood down. They just stood down.
Yeah, yeah. Call the dogs off, Neil.
Yeah.
But it's a song called Missing the War. And it was...
I love that song.
And it's like... All is quiet, a tired eyes.
Yeah.
So it's... There was a man...
Oh, yeah.
God damn, yeah, I absolutely. Love that song.
Look,
see, it makes
I
me
mean,
cuss.
It's inspired, right? I mean, it took me too many years before I thought of You Raise Me Up as like, oh, that's... I think that's Danny Boy, I think, maybe. I don't know.
Right, but I didn't know Danny Boy, so it never occurred to me. Never heard
Well, I mean, well, but I don't, I mean, there's, you know, all the time, you're talking about as a writer now, like I'm constantly afraid. I sent you a melody where I was like, did I rip you off on this? Because I was writing something and I sent you a text saying like, is this yours? And you said, no, it's not. So I continued doing it, but.
I was, you know, I was hoping there's an app, SoundHound. Okay.
SoundHound, sure.
SoundHound, you hum or sing a melody into it, and it tells you what it is. So if someone's like, oh, what's that song? And
an invention that has been needed for so long. That is such a brilliant.
I don't know yet how well it works, or maybe if my singing is just too shitty. But I did experiment with it, and the reason is because almost all the songs that I've ever written that – seemed to be significant at the end of the day. I really thought it was something else for so long. And then it's out there, it's vetted, and it really didn't seem to be something else. But I'm so certain of it. I just have to find out what it is, because I think a good song feels like it came from the earth. It feels like it's something that wasn't written. So I went to SoundHound and started singing some of these things in, and they couldn't find anything. Although I did start singing some of my songs in, and it came out with my song. So I'm not – so they got that right.
They got that right. So
but you might
working.
Try that. Like, you know –
I
like,
will. I've heard about this app peripherally, but I haven't downloaded it, and I absolutely will. I just – in my back of my mind, I'm going, surely this doesn't really work. But, you know, that's not uncommon, that feeling. I think Paul McCartney actually said that when he wrote – I forgot which of his gazillion smash hits he wrote, that he thought, you know, he didn't – finish writing it forever and ever and ever. Beatles historians who were listening to tell me which one it was. I think it was Let It Be or something. But he kept – because he was asking everybody, what is this? I'm copying something. And he wasn't. And sometimes the simplest, most beautiful things have just been right there waiting to take.
What's your newest record is your – what? That's 9 or 10 studio albums?
So I believe this was my ninth that I just released of these of with Solitaire and some others, some classic songs I've wanted to do for a while. And so, yeah, I can't believe that it's been 9 albums now and almost 20 years now in the business.
It's, that's amazing.
Boggling my mind. Where does
the time
go? It
boggles my mind because you just started.
I know. And I don't know. I just kind of try to keep my head down and just keep working. I'm probably going to do a lot of writing for the next album because I usually need kind of an album between the big writing album to kind of refill the tank a little bit. And so I feel lucky as a vocalist first that there's plenty of songs I've always wanted to sing and fans have wanted me to sing. So I kind of check off some of those and find great arrangements. And then I'll say, okay, maybe I'm going to get back at the piano and finish Rude Breeze.
I mean, yeah, and we want to kind of explore that. I didn't like the blues one as much as I like the sensitive one.
I like it's sweet. I think it also is the dichotomy. Well, it's rude, but it's hidden.
Rude Breeze.
So it sounds a lot like Drew Brees, the quarterback for is that the Saints?
Sure.
Rude Breeze blowing through our pod. Rude Breeze. Do you think that you are God?
It's becoming almost a show tune, which ultimately everything of mine winds up becoming. Yeah. This is a perfect masterclass for how all of my writing sessions go, where we start bluesy and end up in a show tune. It's exactly how Rude it's going to go. Because just when I thought I was out, it pulls me back in. We're about to get noisy again. You know, we're rounding third base now and getting back to the idea, the hopefulness at least, of returning some semblance of what normalcy was for us before all this.
That's your next album. It's about to get noisy in here.
It's about to get noisy in here.
Well, man.
Coming at you.
It's just so good to see you. You look awesome.
It's so good to
you
see
look
you
good.
Too. So do you,
you
Ben.
Keep
it's
aging
always
backwards
so good to see
now. You're going back. You're going to have pink eye by
the
end of the day.
The camera's not showing the gray. The camera's not showing the gray.
That's good.
But same to you, my friend. It's always such a pleasure and a privilege to share space with you musically, podcastily, or foodily. It's all joy. We're at a wind shift. Hold tight, everybody.
Rude Breeze.
Rude Breeze. Interrupting our song. You're a rude breeze. Why can't we just get along? Interrupting our song. You're a rude breeze.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.